And President Trump, they know that they do not have the consent of the people, that we do not agree with apartheid, that we do not agree with the occupation of Palestine, and that we want no more walls. No more walls to divide us.
No more walls!
No more walls!
Everybody!
No more walls!
This fascism threat is not new, but the threat of fascism at a moment when the world is about to go up in flames from nuclear weapons and from a climate meltdown, that is new. You know, colonialism isn't new, unfortunately. Racism isn't new. But these other things that could just end it all in the blink of an eye, that is new.
Welcome to On the Ground, the onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio here in Washington, D.C. I'm Esther Evarim. So for 3 years now, On the Ground has been your show here, based in D.C., covering social justice activism in the streets. We go out to rallies, protests, we interview activists, we interview those people on the ground fighting for social justice. And that's why we call the show On the Ground, because we go out of the studio, out in the streets to be with the people. Now, this is the third week of the month when we have our segment, The F Word, Exploring Fascism Today. My special guest today is Jill Stein, U.S. presidential candidate for the Green Party in 2016 and 2012. She will actually be speaking tonight with Ajamu Baraka on the program Next Steps for Independent Politics, Fighting Fascism and Resisting Neoliberalism. And that is at 6:30 p.m. at 1200 U Street in Northwest D.C. I actually have the honor to MC tonight. And so I have a very good discussion that I know you'll find interesting later in the show. But first, let's do our headlines. And today's headlines are all about the rights of people to land, to their heritage and ancestry, and to have that respected. Protesters at the White House in D.C. and New York and around the country greeted Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on his visit with Donald Trump here in D.C., chanting about building a movement and not walls. The activists at the White House linked the human rights violations of the Palestinian people to the plight faced by immigrants coming from our southern border of the United States. Juliana Delora from the group Our Revolution addressed the crowd.
I want to make sure that Netanyahu and President Trump, they know that they do not have the consent of the people, that we do not agree with apartheid, that we do not agree with the occupation of Palestine, and that we want no more walls. No more walls to divide us.
No more walls!
No more walls!
Everybody!
No more walls!
No more walls!
No more walls!
The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe filed a fresh legal challenge this week to the Dakota Access Pipeline, asking a federal judge here in Washington, D.C., to block an easement allowing construction on the final leg of the $3.8 billion project. Water protectors say that the new challenge details shortcuts in the engineering and design of the pipeline that violate construction standards and will render the pipeline more likely to leak and contaminate the land and water. Also here in the D.C. area, an African-American church, Macedonia Baptist Church of Bethesda, Maryland, established in 1920, is fighting the continued desecration of an historic burial ground. Chantel James has more.
I think the fact that we had a really successful demonstration last Sunday, and within 2 days, the Planning Commission had said that they were going to take the cemetery project off of the agenda for the 23rd, is in a sense a reflection of the fact that when people come together and they push back There is a reaction by powerful people.
It was a victory indeed in the eyes of many, including Marsha Coleman Adebayo, the organizer whose voice you just heard. Sunday's protest at Macedonia Baptist Church was well attended, with dozens of citizens gathered. People came to raise their voices against the actions of developer Equity One, which, in collaboration with the Montgomery County Parks and Planning Commission, has made clear its plans to build a parking garage over a property close to the church, which is held to be a sacred ground, the final resting place of hundreds of Africans who lived in the area in times past. Protesters demanded that Black lives, past and present, be respected, and condemned this desecration for the sake of corporate profit as an act of white supremacy that cannot be abided. Harvey Matthews, who is a native of the River Road area that the paved over graveyard is a part of, tells of the history of the conflict between developers and members of the community.
I was born and raised in that area on River Road. And when we was kids, we used to play in the cemetery there. So we know that's not, so it's not a question of the cemetery there or not being there. And it became, when we heard that they was in the process of doing some more building that in the area, like building a garage, parking lot, whatever. It's in basically the same area that you done earlier, and you pretty much got away with that. But then the question is that I had to raise when I moved away and came back to the area is, wow. And they said, well, what did it do to the cemetery? Did they relocate it? Did they dig it up and reload it somewhere else in Maryland? Oh, and that question has not been answered yet.
Another protest against Equity One's plans is scheduled for next week. This is Chantal James.
In D.C., the McMillan Coalition for Sustainable Agriculture is holding a community forum on McMillan Park. What happened and why? Public land versus private profit. Has the growth machine gone too far? And that's going to be March 24th, 6:30 p.m. at the UDC David A. Clark School of Law on Connecticut Avenue. Activists are saying, who is driving and where are we going? This week, students at Howard University also explore the history of Black labor organizing for Black History Month. Chantal James also went to check that out.
The auditorium of Howard University's School of Social Work was filled with Howard students and community members on Valentine's Day of this year who had gathered for a program called Race, Class, and Struggle Then and Now, Lessons from the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. It was both a celebration of the history of the radical organization that got its start organizing auto workers in 1969 Detroit, and a call to action for all those in whom the struggle still lives, after clips from the League of Revolutionary Black Workers Education Media Project were shown, the audience was treated to a dialogue with Jerome Scott, a key member of the organization from its heyday. Scott shared the experiences he's had across his life as a revolutionary and drew connections to today's Black Lives Matter movement. Here, he stresses the importance of direct action.
A lot of people think about movement building and they think only about action. Movement building is at least 50% intellectual. You know, because if you don't know what the fuck you're doing, you can do it forever. You know, and you won't gain anything.
To give to the League of Revolutionary Black Workers Education and Media Project, visit www.revolutionaryworkers.org. From the campus of Howard University, this is Chantal James.
And those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, fighting fascism and resisting neoliberalism with Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein. Stay with us.
This is the third week of the month when we have our segment, The F Word, Exploring Fascism Today. Because of the inauguration coverage last month, this is the first F Word of 2017. In this segment, we've primarily focused on what is happening in the United States and what is emanating from the United States, exported fascism, as some of my guests have called it, through war, genocide, assassinations. My touchstone for this segment has remained the statement by 1960s revolutionary George Jackson, who defined fascism as the complete control of the state by a monopoly capital when the relationship between the state and corporations becomes indiscernible. My guest today is Jill Stein, U.S. presidential candidate for the Green Party in 2016 and 2012. She will be speaking tonight with Ajamu Baraka on the program Next Steps for Independent Politics, Fighting Fascism and Resisting Neoliberalism at 6:30 p.m. at 1200 U Street in Northwest D.C. Jill Stein is an activist and a physician, a medical doctor. So welcome to On the Ground, Dr. Stein, or can I call you Jill?
Please do, yes, and it's great to be with you. Thank you so much, Esther, for all you do.
So I'm so glad you can join me. We're living in a very complex time, politically and economically. Some see the emergence of Donald Trump and Trumpism to be synonymous with a neo-fascist state. But, you know, we've actually been living for decades with outsized corporate control over government and the elections, the military-industrial complex, which seems synonymous with the deep state. And people of color, of course, and the poor have been living for centuries with state violence and murder. So as more people are talking about fascism now and Trump now, what do you see as the new, bigger dangers that we have now that we didn't already have under neoliberal and neoconservative policies?
I think you are right on the money here that we've really had this crisis of capitalism, this crisis of our economy, this crisis of democracy, which, you know, we have never had, but which has been sort of receding into the never world as the economic elite become more and more powerful, as money and power become concentrated in the hands of very few, and as the controls, the checks and balances to the extent that they existed are peeled back, and the oppression of people of color, of ethnic minorities, of immigrants, of indigenous people, of the LGBTQ community. This has been historic, and no one knows it better than people of color, than African Americans and indigenous people who've been colonized for centuries and who have found ways to prevail nonetheless, to fight back and to survive and to really lead the vision forward. I think that struggle has become the norm now. It's no longer confined to people of color and ethnic minorities and even economic minorities. It's become much bigger. And what is this greater threat to society? You know, I think in many ways the pain and suffering and the injustices that have been confined to oppressed groups are now becoming the norm. Does that mean it's getting worse for oppressed groups? Maybe not. But it certainly, you know, is for everyone else. The basic predatory nature of this system has come home to roost. So it presents the potential for a much broader mobilization. And so it's both a perilous moment as well as a moment of incredible opportunity. And when I say perilous, it's not only, you know, to the crisis of human rights, the greater threat to people of color and oppressed communities, the potential for an outright police state, for the declaration of martial law, for the outbreak of a much bigger war than we currently have, and for the potential for environmental catastrophe to be further unleashed, which hits hardest and first on communities of color. But, you know, this is just a taste of what's to come. So, you know, I think while we've seen this in the works for, you know, decades, what we're looking at right now is extremely serious, extremely worrisome, and a great cause to further the radical mobilization that the communities of color have been leading the way on for decades.
In this emerging resistance, well, first of all, you don't really hear what you're talking about in terms of the media coverage of this moment. Most of the coverage that I see on cable news, to the extent that I can stand to watch it, is really kind of talking about a singular focus on one person, Trump. They're not really talking about the harm to the society at large or the attack on working people. So there seems to be a difference between this opposition to increased control by corporations and the billionaire class versus opposition to Trump's more naked style of rule, that he's possibly unseating one group of billionaires and replacing them with another group and allowing these people to run amok in terms of their corporate policies and their control in a way that masks the real oppression that people are facing.
Absolutely. And this corporate, political, and economic system, this oligarchy which controls the mass means of communication, certainly the corporate media, you know, they are pushing back as hard as they possibly can, and they are working to reinterpret a public uprising, a grassroots uprising, and to relabel it, you know, and to call it really a pushback against Trump and the Republicans. Even though this crisis, you know, is very much is a bipartisan crisis, the people who were voting for Donald Trump in majority were actually voting against Hillary Clinton and the neoliberal legacy of the Democrats, which has thrown people under the bus, just like the Republicans have with, you know, with the exporting of our jobs, the creation of low-wage temporary part-time jobs, wages that are barely above the poverty level on average. You know, a generation of young people locked into predatory student loan debt, the housing crisis, you name it. These have been, you know, the expanding war, which consumes, the military consumes more than half of our discretionary budget. These are bipartisan policies that have produced the economic misery that essentially created Trump's victory. It was not a victory of Donald Trump. It was an all-out failure of a predatory economic and political system. So that system is working as hard now as it possibly can because, you know, I think it recognizes that it in fact is the 1% against, you know, a very increasingly oppressed large numbers of people now, arguably well over half the population that are struggling to keep their heads above water for jobs and health care and to afford education and so on. So, you know, they are doing what they usually do, which is to try to divert the fear-mongering going on right now related to the ouster of Michael Flynn. You know, this is being translated into the Russians are coming, you know, essentially. And an effort is being made to turn grassroots resistance into another response out of fear. In the same way that Trump is leading the charge on fear-mongering against immigrants and his effort to demonize immigrants as a threat to our security, you know, the answer of the Democrats to that has been now to demonize Russia, to create this new Cold War rhetoric, and to create a sense of panic about what the Russians are doing and the threat that they pose to us, allegedly. So, yeah, I mean, it is dishonesty all around, and it's fear-mongering all around, and the real struggle right now, Esther, which is why I'm so grateful for independent media like you, the real struggle is for us to realize, you know, and to actually harness the power of this uprising that's going on right now. And, you know, in the words of Alice Walker, to paraphrase her, the biggest way people give up power is by not knowing we have it to start with. There's a lot of power out there which is in revolt right now, and the challenge is to harness that power without allowing it to be co-opted, because as usual, it's the Democrats and their affiliated, well-financed, nonprofit fronts that are out there trying to co-opt the revolt, which is alive and well right now in the streets.
You know, speaking of co-opting and that branding of it, I was really struck. I was actually out of the country when the Women's March happened. And I was actually struck by a few people told me who were there that there was a big difference between what was in the crowd and the sentiments and words of the crowd and what was on the stage. And I also found out afterward that Debbie Wasserman Schultz was one of the speakers. I was really alarmed and shocked to know that this person, Representative Wasserman Schultz, who played such a big role in undermining Bernie Sanders' campaign, played such a big role in that whole defeat of the Democratic Party and the path that the Democratic Party took, was actually up there on the stage speaking at the Women's March. You know? So that's one thing. And then instead of talking about the issues of oppressed people, they're talking about the Russians. On Martin Luther King weekend, the whole controversy happened around John Lewis. And so when Trump denounced John Lewis, said that he was all talk and no action or whatever, instead of this hero of the civil rights movement on Bloody Sunday fighting for voting rights, instead of him talking about how black people were disenfranchised, all the voter suppression that happened around the country, he started talking about the Russians and how the Russians had interfered in the election. Not that his own people were denied the right to vote and their votes weren't counted. He started talking about the Russians. So I feel like, you know, my identity as a woman, my identity as an African-American person, all is being co-opted for this other message instead of what's really happening with me as a black woman.
Yes, and this is kind of, this is the formula for, you know, for oppressors and predators, whether they're fascists or whether they're neoliberals. You know, this is what fear is all about. And fear and fear-mongering distracts us from the real enemies, you know, which is really the control of the 1%, and its war on working people and women and oppressed peoples around the world. This is what they do. And, you know, it's one of the things about fascism, in addition to sort of control of corporations over the economy, which we are just seeing rolling out before our very eyes, you know, in the cabinet of Donald Trump, you know, the cabinet of billionaires and bankers. We're really seeing the poster child here of, you know, of what corporatism looks like. But it's really just an extension of what the Democrats have been doing. Their cabinets have been full, and the Treasury has been run by bankers and Goldman Sachs and all that. But the point I wanted to make here was that another characteristic of fascism, aside from corporate power, is its violence, its use of hatred, its use of fear-mongering, its militarism. And along with that goes this collapse of a sense of community and the collapse of our sense of connection, our sense of the public good and the commons. It all gets sort of disappeared in this kind of cult of cutthroat competition, which goes hand in hand, again, with neoliberalism and neo-fascism, and why the neoliberalism produces fascism, because neoliberalism destroys our sense of community and of belonging and of any kind of justice being built into our societies, our, you know, our housing, our right to a job, our right to living wages, all of that gets destroyed. And it was destroyed by neoliberalism, which really hollowed out our sense of who we are. And so yeah. It's no wonder, you know, we're not only seeing this rise of right-wing extremism and fascism, you know, and the collapse of our of a just and viable economy, but also you're seeing this in the health, the very health statistics right now. And in particular, you know, it's the white, uneducated, worker whose mortality rates have skyrocketed. And like their rates of, what is it? I think suicide went up like 80%. I mean, it practically doubled over the last decade. So, you know, we're sort of seeing here playing out in so many dimensions that suddenly, white people who were protected from this predatory society are now also the victims of it. And they don't have some kind of a binding ideology or vision like that Martin Luther King provided. It provided an alternative framework. And white working people have lost that because of the war on the labor movement. Maybe, you know, they had it in the 1930s. They don't have it now. So they've become very susceptible to this predatory fascism, which is out there now, and which we don't have to be the victims of. And in fact, we are fighting back. And in the words of Alice Walker again, you know, it's all about realizing the power that we have. But that depends on our getting together and using it and sort of redefining this crisis to put us in charge of a vision and an agenda that we can achieve.
If you're just tuning in, this is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org. I'm Esther Avaram, and I'm in conversation with Jill Stein, U.S. presidential candidate for the Green Party in 2016 and 2012. But right now, we need to take a break. We'll be right back.
Everybody over there,
get on up.
Everybody right there,
get into it.
Everybody right there,
get involved.
Everybody, you. Come on. Come on. Come on. Come on. Come on with your come on. Come on. Come on. Everybody over there,
get on up.
Everybody. Come on! Don't raise your hand. Don't raise your hand. Get on up.
Get on up.
Get into it.
Get involved.
Get involved.
Get on up.
Get involved.
Get into it.
Wait. 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 You. And you. Doing your thing.
Military, and I want to talk about, you know, Trump just had a press conference, and I was shocked to hear him talk about how he is going to rebuild our military and make our military stronger. And I'm thinking, what percentage of our budget already goes to the military? And then I listened to him further, and he was really talking about the police. He wasn't just talking about our military fighting abroad, that he wants to give all this additional money to the police. That, you know, we are already having trouble with so much of our domestic budget, our city's budgets going to police as opposed to human needs. I think somewhere like in Baltimore, I had the statistic on a recent show that so much more goes to the police as opposed to education. And this is the same thing in cities across the country, even in New York City. When you look at what the city is paying for police versus education. So that's just a follow-up on what you were talking about, militarization of society.
Yes, exactly. And in that outrageous fact, which plays out at the national level, that it's 54% of our discretionary budget, which is spent on the military, which is not making us safer, which is creating failed states and mass refugee migrations and worse terrorist threats. You know, it's not only that it's devouring our resources, but that it's using them in a very outrageous, immoral, and destructive way. And that's playing out in our cities as well. And I know that statistic applies to Los Angeles as well, where a full 50% of their city budget is spent on the police, you know, on the domestic military, our police. So it's outrageous that money could be spent, you know, far more effectively preventing crime and violence by providing quality schools and after-school programs and enrichment and all that.
And jobs.
Yeah, that's for sure. Absolutely. But I want to focus on one thing you said about this kind of sense of hopelessness, to just recognize that this is their purpose. Their purpose here is to create a dog and pony show that makes us feel hopeless, because if we're hopeless, then we're powerless. It's really important to recognize that, in fact, we do have the power, and that there is a massive revolt going on right now. And it's actually at all levels of society, because Trump is proving himself to be such an incredibly incompetent, unstable, and, you know, just dysfunctional occupant of the White House, and the alarm has gone off. I think, you know, even in, not to mention Democrats, but certainly even in Republicans right now. So this could be a man whose days are numbered for all kinds of reasons. But even that aside, you know, this is a man who began his presidency being the most unpopular president in history, as well as the most unpopular candidate, and who only squeaked in because people were voting against the other candidate, who was also extremely unpopular. But he begins with, you know, with all these business encumbrances that he's refused to separate himself from. He has 500 businesses, many of them scattered around the globe. So he basically is in violation of ethical, legal, and constitutional statutes that are going to tie him up in knots and have already made him susceptible to impeachment efforts. And the last thing I want to say here on this thought is that it's important to look at what other countries are doing right now, because people have gotten out in huge numbers in places like Guatemala about a year ago to basically get rid of their president, who then promptly went to jail on account of corruption. Same thing is happening in South Korea, where people have mobilized by the millions in order to begin impeachment proceedings. You know, the kinds of corruption that Trump has already demonstrated, not to mention his incredible incompetence and his violation of human rights, has given us enormous momentum, and it's important not to underestimate that and not to forget what we did as a mobilized movement under Richard Nixon, where we brought the troops home, we established women's right to choose from a very regressive Supreme Court, we improved workers' rights, health and safety with OSHA, we established the Environmental Protection Agency, and then, you know, and then he was impeached. And he was one of the most regressive and corrupt presidents in our history. Now, that's a good precedent for us to be mindful of what happens when we actually stand up with the courage of our convictions and, you know, and we work together.
I've heard a number of people talk about the whole issue of impeachment. And of course, they say, well, we'll just wind up with Pence. and they don't look forward to that and consider him like the Dark Lord or the Voldemort or something, you know. But what we see happening right now with these roundups around the country, you know, mass, you know, fear in the immigrant community, the movement for Black Lives is keeping a watch on what's happening with the police in our communities. So is this kind of oppression of people of color, national minorities, being used by this current administration to, I guess, placate the racists who supported him because he can't deliver on these economic promises? He says, you know, when he just had his press conference, he's delivering on his promises, right? But do you see that this is a promise he can deliver on? He can deliver on the racism, but he can't bring back jobs magically from Mexico or from wherever they went.
Absolutely. I mean, and this is why this is the basic formula of fascism, you know, that it cannot deliver, that it is not an effective or coherent way to run a society. You cannot run a society based on hate and fear, which is essentially what fascism is. It's really a society that's gone off the rails, that has lost its soul and its sense of community. And when it loses its soul, it also loses its heart and its mind. This is not a way, you know, as Martin Luther King said, we have a choice between community or chaos, and fascism is chaos. And this is why, you know, fascist movements and leaders have always relied on keeping people really under a sense of siege, and that the enemy is both within, and that is people of color and immigrants, and the enemy is also at our gates, and that's other countries, and that's why they need to go to war. So, you know, we are in this incredibly perilous moment. Donald Trump is not a popular man, and he's had really nothing but chaos in this first, you know, almost month of his regime, and he is very much in defensive mode. So it's really important for us to be mindful that the opposition is gaining power and numbers, and we, the people, you know, and oppressed people in particular, are the leadership of this opposition and are its heart and soul and mind. And it's up to us to really define what this new world looks like, as oppressed communities have long been doing. They haven't just been in defensive mode. They've been in the mode of like Cooperation Jackson, which is looking at sort of what does a just and equitable society look like. And it's important to know that Donald Trump and this fascist state that we have become and that threatens to become much worse, it's not only oppressed people who are really frightened by its potential, but it's really most thinking people right now who really get that we are in a state of slow economic collapse. We're in a state of assault on human rights, whether it's black people or indigenous people or the LGBTQ community or women. That's a lot of people. And it's also people who get what's going on with the environment, with environmental racism, and with this very rapid meltdown that's going on right now of the climate and ecosystems. And people who are tuned into that understand that we do not have a future. And a generation of young people, there's 44 million people who are trapped into predatory student loan. There are so many groups that can be mobilized right now. You know, this is why I myself am a member of an independent third party, because none of these movements can do it alone. And when you start building coalitions that are going to stay together with a clear vision and a clear agenda, and for us in the Green Party, it's essentially an agenda that puts people, planet, and peace over profit.
I want to talk to you about that, but I need us to take a little break right now. If you're just tuning in, this is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org. I'm Esther Averam, and I'm in conversation with Jill Stein, U.S. presidential candidate for the Green Party in 2016 and 2012. She'll be speaking tonight with Ajamu Baraka on the program Next Steps for Independent Politics, Fighting Fascism and Resisting Neoliberalism. That's at 6:30 p.m. at 1200 U Street in Northwest D.C. But right now we need to take a break. We'll be right back.
Breaking rocks out here on the chain gang. Breaking rocks and serving my time. Breaking rocks out here on the chain gang, 'cause they done convicted me of crime. Hold it steady right there while I hit it. Well, I reckon that ought to get it. Been working and working, but I still got so terribly far to go. I committed crime, Lord, I need it. Crime of being hungry and poor. I left the grocery store, man, breathing, when they caught me robbing a store. Hold it steady right there while I hit it. Well, I reckon that ought to get it. Been working and working, but I still got so terribly far to go. I heard the judge say 5 years on chain gang you gonna go. I heard the judge say 5 years of labor. I heard my old man scream, Lordy, no. Hold it right there while I hit it. Well, I reckon that ought to get it. Been working and working, but I still got so terribly far to go. See my sweet honey babe, gonna break this chain off the rung. I'm gonna lay down somewhere shady. Lord, I sure am hot in the sun. Hold it right there while I hit it. Well, I reckon that ought to get it. Been working and working, working.
Before we went to the break, you were getting ready to talk about the Green Party and the importance of independent politics.
Yes, absolutely. And I also just want to underscore, just to say that independent media is absolutely critical in this fight against fascism. It really is all about shoring up the power of community and the resistance that's going on here at the community level. So big shout out for you and thank you so much and support this public radio station. So yes, I mean, for me, I was a very latecomer to political organizing and political activism. I was a social activist, largely starting out of healthcare and then environment and environmental racism, because that's where, you know, where environment and racism converge is where people get the sickest and are most at risk. And then, you know, it was a gradual awakening for me over a decade or two that one issue at a time, we will be divided and conquered. It requires coalitions. Coalitions require time and energy and care and nurturing. So if you actually want to build a coalition that can get something done and that can stay together, that's basically called a political party. A real coalition of, by, and for the people. That's what politics should be, as opposed to what we see in the corporate political parties, which are really not coalitions. These are really Trojan horses for the oligarchy and for the 1%. So, you know, it's these independent, non-corporate politics, and the Green Party refuses to take corporate donations, and we also refuse to take donations from the surrogates of corporations, and that means their CEOs, their executives, their attorneys, and their lobbyists. So, you know, we are firewalled against that kind of corruption. But at the end of the day, this is what we need. And my daily experience on the ground underscores for me that these are political battles. They depend on coalitions, and ultimately they depend on power, because we can mobilize a lot of people in the streets, but unless we also take the reins of power, all we do in the streets will essentially be steamrolled in the blink of an eye by the things that the power holders can do with us. And it's when social movements get together with political movements, that's when we become an unstoppable force that has really created transformative change, like the abolition of slavery, like the labor movement and the women's movement.
So, you know, speaking of the labor movement, you know, how can the left get organized labor to support job growth, you know, outside of this increasingly privatized, you know, mass incarceration industry or war? And then also, we just had recently some labor supporting the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline and coming out in opposition to the protesters. So how do we, you know, make inroads with organized labor?
Those are two really important questions. You know, one is sort of how do we change policy? And then the other one is how do we change organized labor? And ideally, they would both change together, and organized labor would be a force on behalf of good wages and a national living wage and a national right to a job with a living wage and an emergency jobs program that would also solve the crisis of the climate, which is what we call for in the Green Party, an emergency Green New Deal, which could actually solve both the economic crisis and the climate crisis in one fell swoop. And this, at the same time, it would also make wars for oil obsolete. So, you know, it would do a world of good, and there are lots of reasons why this should happen. And there's actually a fair amount of momentum right now, you know, towards greening our energy supply and all that. But we have to make sure that that translates into good jobs for everyday people. And it's really critical that this progress towards renewable energy be tied to progress on labor, on employment, on democratizing energy so that energy becomes a public utility, which in fact is run by municipal utilities, you know, or other publicly owned energy organizations that provide that energy for the public, not for profit. The question of how do we move labor along, you know, I think labor is in a real crisis right now, and all the more so after Hillary Clinton's loss, after so many working people defected to support Trump And then after many labor leaders, especially in the construction industry, appeared with Trump in the White House saying that they were going to work with him. You know, the reality about these jobs, these construction jobs altogether, they are getting more and more dangerous because of the attack on unions, and the death rate is going up enormously on the job for construction workers, and the threats to health and safety in the energy industry is also off the charts. The chance of dying when you walk into a fracking job, or you drive a fossil fuel truck, or you go to an oil rig, or you go work at a refinery, the odds of your dying on the job go up 700% compared to other work. And that's just like the acute illnesses. There's this whole other thing of the cancers that are down the line and the heart disease and all that from these toxic exposures. So this is very dangerous work. And, you know, in many ways, the working people in those industries that I have talked to, they are just really chomping at the bit for jobs in the renewable energy sector. And I think it may take us outside of the labor movement to get it going, but I think we're going to increasingly fan the flames of revolt inside of organized labor, which is organized on an old model that puts people in charge who have big salaries, who are out of touch from the grassroots. We need a different model for labor organizing, more like the Chicago Teachers Union, for example, which is much more grassroots and bottom-up. So there is hope out there, but it's going to take a lot of work inside of labor and outside of labor.
Finally, speaking of coalition building, I wanted to get your thoughts on whether you thought the run of Bernie Sanders made it clear that people are open to different types of independent politics. And also, I'm wondering if it's possible that Trump's election will break down some more of these silos of various issues on the left. You know, is an anti-fascist movement building on the left? And what kind of anti-fascist coalition would be effective? In doing this series, I actually read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, and it was really instructive in terms of talking about how the left failed to come together. The left could not mount an effective coalition to defeat Hitler. And so I'm wondering, when I look at the left versus maybe some of the traditional Democratic Party politics, whether the problem right now is that the left really doesn't see the Democrats as being progressive. And how can you be in coalition with people who really aren't fighting against the same thing? So what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the question of the hour. And I have to say that, you know, for decades we've been fighting neoliberalism, and I feel like I'm very comfortable with how we fight neoliberalism and how we call it out for what it is, really, you know, a Trojan horse for the 1%. Fascism is a little different, and I feel like this is new. We're on totally different terrain here. So I feel like I'm, like so many other people, am really in intensive kind of dialogue mode right now and sort of study mode to see, you know, what does history tell us here, and what can we learn for how to fight this effectively. You know, but I feel like we can learn an awful lot just from the oppressed communities who've been fighting colonialism forever and who have, you know, who have learned how to survive and prevail. And there are big lessons in that. And I feel like the lessons can get no bigger than the lessons of Martin Luther King, who basically defined this struggle in a very human way to say that this is a choice between chaos or community. You know, and to define kind of the triple evils of, what did he say, militarism, racism, and extreme materialism, aka capitalism. You know, they all kind of go together, and we have to fight that, in a very big and embracing way, is kind of my sense from just being on the ground as an activist for a couple of decades, and that we descend into sort of the circular firing squad if we start putting labels first. I think it's really important that we put principles first. And this is, I guess, a principle that has made a lot of sense to me, which is not to say, you know, oh, are you a Democrat or a Green or an Independent, but rather, do you disavow, do you repudiate control by corporate money? If you repudiate control by corporate money, I don't care what your title is, you know, because it means then that we can have a human dialogue and we can actually build community and, you know, we can come out of this as a force that's working together. If you don't repudiate corporate money, then you're in trouble and you're going to be overtaken by the 1%. And that was the problem with the Democrats. And that was the problem with Bernie Sanders running inside of the Democratic Party. While he had a principled campaign with some limits, he made concessions, I think, to the Democratic Party, like militarism, for example. But to the extent, he was a small donor campaign and he did the right thing to repudiate big corporate money. But the Democratic Party did not. And at the end of the day, he was destroyed. And all the principled people who wanted to work with him, who thought it was hopeful, their hopes were shattered on this altar of big money. So, you know, I'm hopeful that we can define our future perhaps in a different way. This fascism threat is not new, but the threat of fascism at a moment when the world is about to go up in flames from nuclear weapons and from a climate meltdown, that is new. You know, colonialism isn't new, unfortunately. Racism isn't new. But these other things that could just end it all in the blink of an eye, that is new, and I think it gives a new urgency to our effort to find common ground, to find that community that Martin Luther King talked about amidst the chaos, because our lives depend on it now. Our lives depend on creating an America and a world that works for all of us, that's based on principles of people, planet, and peace over profit. And that's where we've got to go, and quickly.
I've been speaking with Jill Stein, U.S. presidential candidate for the Green Party in 2016 and 2012. She'll be speaking tonight with Ajamu Baraka on the program Next Steps for Independent Politics, Fighting Fascism and Resisting Neoliberalism. That's 6:30 p.m. at 1200 U Street in Northwest D.C. Thank you, Jill.
Thank you, Esther. It was great talking with you.
And that will do it for us on the Ground, onthegroundshow.org. Thanks to our guest today, Jill Stein. Thanks to Chantel James, Lydia, and Michael Byfield. Thanks to our engineer, Mike Red Eagle Nacella. And thank you for listening. You can reach us at onthegroundshow.org, where you can listen to all of our shows. Please don't forget to like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. Raise your voice out there. Peace. I'm